A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt. He's been thinking about the idea of margin in social well-being. Not margin in the financial trading sense, but margin as buffer, as breathing room. Having leftover time that's unplanned. Having a cushion in your finances instead of living exactly at your means. He points out we talk endlessly about the problem of living beyond your means, but almost nobody talks about the danger of living exactly at your means. And that applies across every domain. Time, money, relationships, emotional capacity. So the question is, how do you factor margin into all of it? And he wants us to talk about how to factor margin into all domains of life. This is a good one.
There's a physician named Richard Swenson who wrote a book called Margin back in the 90s. He defined it as the space between our load and our limits.
Brittle is the right word. A system with zero slack breaks the moment anything unexpected happens. And everything is always unexpected eventually.
The moment one thing went wrong, the whole system collapsed. He wrote a book called, appropriately, Margin, back in the 90s, and he defined it as, I'm quoting here, the space between our load and our limits. He was seeing patients in his medical practice who were, by every objective measure, healthy. And his framework was that margin isn't a luxury. It's a prerequisite for health. If load is everything you're carrying, and limits are what you can actually bear, then margin is the gap between them.
Between our load and our limits. That's clean. So margin isn't a luxury add-on. It's the structural gap that keeps the whole thing from collapsing.
Swenson's argument was that progress itself had systematically eliminated margin. Every labor-saving device, every efficiency gain, every convenience, instead of creating more slack, it raised expectations. It's not. It's brittle. There's a concept from engineering that maps perfectly here, brittle versus ductile failure. A brittle material snaps the moment you exceed its limit because there's no give.
Which is an elegant way of saying the hedonic treadmill isn't just for happiness. It's for capacity, too. Every time we get faster, the baseline resets.
This connects directly to what psychologists now call time affluence. Ashley Willens at Harvard Business School has done some of the best work. It really does. But the principle holds. Swenson identified four domains, emotional margin, physical margin, financial margin, and what he called margin in relationships.
Even though more money doesn't reliably buy more happiness past a certain point, and more time does.
Willens ran a study where she asked thousands of people, if you had an extra $40, would you spend it on a time-saving purchase, like having groceries delivered, or on a material purchase? Only about half chose time. Time affluence is the term in the research literature. It's the subjective sense that you have enough time to do the things you want to do.
The insight isn't just rich people can afford margin. It's that most of us, even when we can afford it, don't prioritize it. We treat time like it's less real than money.
People who feel time poor tend to make choices that make them even more time poor.
Until there is. Until you're sitting in traffic and you realize you've been running at exactly capacity for 6 months, and one more thing will genuinely break you.
You feel rushed, so you eliminate the things that make life feel spacious, which makes you feel more rushed.
The cure for time poverty is doing things that look, on paper, like a worse use of time.
That's the counterintuitive finding. Cassie Mogelner at Wharton found that giving people an unexpected block of free time didn't increase their sense of time affluence unless they used it for social connection or something personally meaningful. If they used it to catch up on email, they felt worse. Financial margin, time margin, emotional margin, and what I'd call relational margin. The buffer in your social obligations.
Start with financial. This is the one that personal finance people talk about constantly, but they usually frame it wrong. How do you actually build it in? Because leave blank space in your calendar is easy to say, but most people don't control their schedule that tightly to begin with. The prompt's framing is different. It's about not living exactly at your means, even in normal times. Having slack in the monthly budget that isn't earmarked for anything. Money that just sits there, making the whole thing breathe.
The research on cognitive task switching backs this up. The brain needs a reset period between different types of work, and when you don't give it that, your performance on the next task drops measurably. It's not because they're spending recklessly. It's because their fixed costs expand to exactly match their income. Depending on the study, anywhere from 20 to 40% on complex cognitive tasks. Gloria Mark at UC Irvine found that after an interruption, it takes an average of 23 minutes to return to the original task at full focus.
The financial equivalent of a submarine with no ballast tanks. One leak, and you're at the bottom.
The data on this is sobering. The Federal Reserve has consistently found that somewhere around 40% of American households couldn't cover an unexpected $400 expense without borrowing or selling something. That's before you factor in decision fatigue. Every switch is a micro-decision about what to do next, and those add up. By the end of a day with no margin, you're making worse decisions.
$400? That's a car repair. A trip to the emergency room with decent insurance. A pet getting sick.
The really insidious thing is, when you have no financial margin, small problems become big problems. A $400 car repair goes on a credit card. The credit card interest makes next month tighter. At the start of the day, about 65% of parole requests were granted. Right before a break, it dropped to nearly zero. After the break, it shot back up. The difference wasn't the cases, it was the judge's cognitive depletion.
Which is the exact same dynamic as time margin. A day with no slack turns a 15-minute delay into a ruined afternoon.
And the time domain is where I think the research gets really interesting. There was a fascinating study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology a few years ago. I think that's the ethical dimension people miss. When you have no margin, you're not just harming yourself, you're making worse decisions that affect other people. You're less patient with your kids, you're less generous with your spouse. Margin is a social good, not just a personal one.
That's a good segue to financial margin. Because the personal finance space talks about emergency funds constantly, but I think they frame it wrong.
In the short term, yes. It narrows your attention. Your brain treats time pressure like a threat, and threat responses shut down the parts of you that think about other people. This isn't a moral failure. It's a cognitive bandwidth problem.
What the prompt is getting at, living below your means instead of exactly at them, is different. It's about the daily experience of not having to care. They wrote scarcity, why having too little means so much. And the core finding was that scarcity, of money, of time, of anything, consumes mental bandwidth. There's that study, the one about sugarcane farmers.
This is from Sendhil Mulanathan and Eldar Shafir's work on scarcity. They studied sugarcane farmers in India who get paid once a year after harvest. Same farmers, same intelligence, but their cognitive performance dropped by about 13 IQ points in the period right before harvest when they were financially tight, compared to after harvest when they had money.
Which is the best argument for margin I've ever heard. It's not about relaxation. It's about preserving your ability to think clearly and be decent to people.
Here's where the practical question gets tricky. How do you actually build time margin when everything in modern life is designed to eliminate it? It wasn't that they were stressed about money in some abstract way. It was that every decision had to account for the constraint. That constant accounting uses the same executive function resources you need for everything else.
I think part of the answer is that you have to treat unplanned time as a non-negotiable line item, not a leftover. Most people plan their obligations, and then whatever's left is free time. Which means the person living exactly at their means is walking around with a permanent cognitive handicap they don't even recognize as a handicap. They think that's just how thinking feels.
The tragedy is, it's often the most responsible people who fall into this. They budget meticulously. They account for every dollar.
Which sounds impossible to most people. They'll say, I can't just block off 2 hours of nothing on a Tuesday. But the reality is, you're already blocking it. You're just calling it something else. The over-optimized budget is the financial equivalent of the calendar with no white space. Looks pristine on paper. Shatters on contact with reality.
There's a rule of thumb in personal finance that captures this well, the 50-30-20 rule. But I've seen a modification that adds a margin category explicitly. Something like 55% needs, 20% wants, 15% savings, 10% unstructured margin. Money that's allocated to nothing.
Money that's allocated to nothing. I love that phrase. What's the behavioral argument for it?
It reduces the friction of unexpected expenses. If you have a margin category, the car repair doesn't require redoing your entire budget. It doesn't trigger the "I've failed" feeling. It just comes out of margin, and next month margin is a little thinner, but the system didn't break. It's the difference between a budget that's a straitjacket and a budget that's a guideline.
The psychological difference between "I planned for the unexpected" and "I failed to plan" is enormous, even though the dollar amount might be identical. If you're operating right at the edge of what you can handle emotionally, one difficult conversation, one piece of bad news, one friend who needs more than you can give, and you're done.
There's a concept in psychology called emotional labor. It was originally articulated by Arlie Hochschild in the 80s. The idea that managing your emotions, particularly in service of a job or a social role, is actual work. Emotional margin is essentially your capacity to handle additional emotional demands without becoming dysregulated. It's what lets you stay patient when your kid is having a meltdown after you've had a terrible day.
Which is why people in caring professions burn out so reliably. It's not that they don't care enough, it's that they're asked to perform emotional labor continuously, without the margin to replenish.
It's not just professionals. Parents, especially parents of young children, operate with chronically depleted emotional margin. Every parent I've ever talked to about this, and I saw this in my practice constantly, describes the same thing. It's absolutely finite. Emotional regulation is a resource that gets used up. If you spend all day suppressing your reactions in meetings, you have less left for your family in the evening.
What replenishes it?
Sleep is the big one. Time in nature. There's solid evidence that even 20 minutes in a natural setting lowers cortisol measurably. Social connection that doesn't demand anything from you.
Which is its own kind of margin debt. You're running a deficit, and the guilt compounds it.
Let's talk about relational margin, because this is where all of these domains converge. Relational margin is the buffer in your social obligations. It comes from attention restoration theory. Directed attention, the kind you use for work and problem solving, is a limited resource.
The prompt framing is useful here too. We talk constantly about the problem of overcommitting, saying yes to too many things. Doom scrolling is the opposite of margin. It feels like rest because you're not working, but it's actively consuming emotional bandwidth.
It's borrowing against tomorrow's margin, and the debt compounds.
What about relational margin? You mentioned Swenson had that as a fourth category.
Relational margin is the buffer in your relationships. It's the goodwill and trust that accumulates when things are good, so that when there's conflict or stress, the relationship doesn't break. Every relationship has a balance.
Think about what we were saying about the 40% of households that can't handle a $400 emergency. Some of those people could probably make different choices and build more margin. The Gottman ratio. Housing, healthcare, education, the big three, have all risen faster than inflation. You can't budget your way out of structural marginlessness.
That's relational margin. It's about building up such a deep reserve that a fight doesn't feel existential.
The same applies to friendships, presumably.
The friend you haven't talked to in 6 months but can call at 2 a.m.? That's relational margin. It was built over years of positive interactions, and it doesn't evaporate the moment you're not actively maintaining it. But if you never built it in the first place, the friendship is brittle. One misunderstanding, and it's over.
I think the interesting question here is whether margin in different domains is fungible. Can financial margin compensate for time poverty? Can relational margin cover for emotional depletion?
The research suggests limited fungibility. Money can buy some time back. You can outsource tasks, pay for convenience, but it doesn't create the subjective sense of time affluence, and emotional margin is the least fungible of all.
Let's get practical. If someone's listening and thinking, "I have no margin in any domain, and I don't know where to start," what's the first move?
I think the first move is an audit, not a budget, an audit. Go through a typical week and identify where you're operating at 100% capacity. Where are the points of zero slack? Is it your mornings? That's a sharp way to put it, and it connects to something I've been thinking about, Margin isn't just an individual concern. Organizations need margin too.
The goal of the audit isn't to fix anything yet. It's just to see it. Because most people don't actually know where their margin has disappeared to. They just feel the absence.
We saw this during COVID. The systems that had no margin collapsed. Even just $50 a month that isn't allocated to anything.
Because margin is fractal. A little bit of margin in one domain creates breathing room that spills into others. If you have financial margin, a car repair doesn't consume emotional margin. If you have time margin, a friend's crisis doesn't consume relational margin.
The domains aren't independent, they're interconnected. Margin in one place reduces the load on all the others.
I think the other practical move, and this one's harder, is learning to sit with the discomfort of unallocated resources. Because margin feels wasteful if you've been trained to optimize everything.
His argument was that in tightly coupled systems with no slack, accidents aren't aberrations. They're inevitable. A small failure cascades into catastrophe because there's no buffer between components. So they fill the margin immediately with more tasks, more commitments, more spending.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. You can't stand the silence, so you put on something forgettable just to have noise.
The car breaks down, which makes you late for work, which gets you in trouble, which adds stress, which affects your sleep, which affects your health, which creates medical expenses, which strains the budget further.
Which is fundamentally countercultural. Every signal we get tells us to maximize, optimize, monetize. Margin is the decision to leave capacity on the table, deliberately.
There's a concept from engineering that I think maps beautifully onto this. In systems design, you never run a system at full capacity. You always leave headroom. A server running at 95% CPU is a server that's about to crash. I think you start with the domain that's causing the most active pain, because that's where a small intervention has the most leverage.
We design human lives with a safety factor of zero.
And then we're surprised when they fail.
The safety factor framing is useful because it reframes margin from nice to have to required for continued function. You don't call it wasteful when a bridge is twice as strong as it needs to be. You call it not collapsing.
Every time you have to choose to save instead of spend, you're using up the very resource you're trying to protect. And he was already saying, the direction of progress is toward less margin, not more. Every new capability creates a new expectation, and expectations fill all available capacity.
The only way to have margin is to actively resist the default direction of the culture. You can't drift into margin. You have to build it intentionally, against the current.
$100 of financial buffer means one less thing to worry about, which frees up a little cognitive bandwidth, which helps you make slightly better decisions, which builds more margin.
The virtuous cycle version of the scarcity trap.
Mullinathan and Shafir talk about this too. Scarcity creates a tunnel effect. You focus intensely on the immediate problem, which helps you solve it, but at the cost of neglecting everything else. Margin is what lets you lift your head up and see the broader landscape.
I want to go back to time margin for a minute, because I think there's a cultural dimension here that's worth naming. We've built a society that valorizes busyness. How are you? It's the default answer, and it's also a status signal.
And the psychological shift is from what can I afford to what leaves me with margin. Those are very different questions. Can I afford this car payment? Is a yes-no question that encourages you to spend right up to the limit. There's research on this. In Western cultures, particularly in the US, busyness is associated with high status. People assume busy people are important and competent. In some European cultures, leisure signals status more than busyness does.
It's the difference between surviving the month and being able to handle the month plus something else.
For time margin, the most practical advice I've seen comes from the time blocking literature, but with a twist. Most time blocking tells you to schedule everything, including leisure. Or redefine what importance looks like. The person who's never rushed, who always has time for a conversation, who doesn't check their phone constantly, that's a different kind of status signal.
How much margin are we talking about? What's a reasonable target?
The research on this is still emerging, but there are some benchmarks. I think the practical version is just protecting a few non-negotiables. Not trying to build margin across your entire life at once, but identifying the two or three things that actually restore you and defending them ruthlessly.
1 to 2 hours a day sounds luxurious to most people, But it's also less than 10% of waking hours. The fact that it sounds luxurious says more about our baseline than about the target.
And for people who are starting from zero, even 30 minutes of protected empty time can be transformative. The key is that it's protected. It doesn't get bumped when something else comes up.
Which means you have to treat it as seriously as a meeting with your boss. You wouldn't cancel on your boss because a friend wanted to grab coffee, but you'll cancel on yourself constantly.
Because we've been trained to treat commitments to ourselves as optional. They're not. They're the foundation that makes all the other commitments possible.
What about emotional margin? How do you build that?
Look at that bird outside. How was your day? The response to those bids is what builds or erodes relational margin. You can turn toward, turn away, or turn against. Most people only notice they're out of emotional capacity when they snap at someone or shut down. By then, you're already in deficit.
It's like the gaslight in your car. By the time it comes on, you're already running on fumes. You need to learn to refill at half a tank.
It's in the accumulation of tiny moments where you either acknowledge the other person's bid or you ignore it. The common thread is that it's time when you're not performing emotional labor for anyone else.
This is where the overlap with time margin becomes really clear. If you have no empty time, you have no opportunity to refill emotionally. The two are coupled.
And relational margin. This is the one that I think is most neglected in the discourse. Relational margin is the capacity to be available to people beyond your immediate family and obligations. It's what allows you to be a good friend, a helpful neighbor, a present community member.
Relational margin gets squeezed first because it looks optional. Your job isn't optional. Your kids aren't optional. But checking in on a friend who's going through a divorce, that's technically optional, so it's the first thing to go when margin disappears.
But those hours don't maintain the friendship once it's built. What maintains it is consistency of contact, not total hours. You can't be a good friend in the 5 minutes between meetings.
The erosion of margin isn't just making us tired. It's making us worse friends, worse neighbors, worse community members. It's atomizing.
This is where I think the cultural conversation has really failed. We talk about burnout as an individual problem with individual solutions. Take a vacation, do some yoga, practice self-care. The tragedy is, the people who need relational margin the most, the ones who are isolated or lonely, are often the ones whose lives are structured in ways that make consistency impossible.
Self-care as the glockenspiel of corporate approachability. It sounds nice, it signals something, but it doesn't actually solve the structural problem.
That's a perfect way to put it. The self-care industry has turned margin into a consumer product. Buy this candle. Download this meditation app. Take this wellness retreat. But margin isn't something you buy. It's something you protect.
It's the difference between treating the symptom and treating the disease. The symptom is feeling depleted. The disease is having no reserve capacity. A candle doesn't create reserve capacity.
The people who most need margin are the ones least able to create it.
Which is why policy matters here. Things like predictable scheduling laws, paid leave, affordable childcare. These are margin-creating policies. They build buffer into the system so individuals don't have to do it all themselves. If I'm not responding to emails at 10 p.m., am I still dedicated?
That is a deeply uncomfortable question for a lot of people, and it's reinforced by workplace cultures that equate presence with commitment. If you leave at 5, you're not a team player. If you don't answer on the weekend, you're not serious.
They make better decisions. They're more creative. They're better colleagues because they're not constantly on the edge of snapping.
They live at zero margin because wages haven't kept up with costs, and the buffer got squeezed out from both sides. People got the same amount of work done in fewer hours because they had more margin for recovery.
Part of building margin is learning to say no.
And no is a skill. It's uncomfortable in the moment, but it's what creates the space for yes to the things that actually matter. The person who can't say no to anything ends up saying no to everything important by default, because there's no room left.
The slow yes. I read something once, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. Which sounds extreme, but as a heuristic for protecting margin, it's not bad.
And I think the spirit of it is right, even if the literal application is too rigid. The point is that most things should be a no. The default should be protected time, protected energy, protected attention. You opt into things deliberately rather than drifting into them.
which is the opposite of how most people operate. The default is yes until the calendar is full, and then maybe no. The child tax credit expansion during the pandemic, which gave families financial margin and had dramatic effects on child poverty.
The child tax credit is a really instructive case. When it was expanded in 2021, child poverty dropped by about 30% almost immediately. That's not because parents suddenly became more financially literate. I think you ask four questions. For time margin, do you regularly have unplanned time, and does it feel spacious rather than anxious? For financial margin, could you handle a surprise expense without it changing your month?
Margin was created by a policy decision and destroyed by a policy decision. It wasn't about individual choices at all.
For relational margin, are your key relationships in surplus or deficit? Do you have more positive interactions than negative ones? And is there enough of a buffer that a conflict wouldn't feel threatening? If your wages haven't kept up with housing costs, no amount of budgeting creates margin.
This is the part of the conversation that makes some people uncomfortable, because it implies that margin is partly a collective responsibility, not just an individual virtue.
If you feel a spike of anxiety when your phone buzzes, if you dread opening your banking app, if you find yourself avoiding certain people because interacting with them feels like a demand you can't meet, those are signals that margin is gone. But telling someone to build margin when their rent consumes 60% of their income is like telling someone to run a marathon with a broken leg. The advice isn't wrong, it's just insufficient.
On the flip side, there are plenty of people with ample financial margin who have zero time margin or emotional margin because they've optimized their lives for income at the expense of everything else. That's almost poetic. Write that on a mug.
I'll put it on a t-shirt. Dread is just the absence of margin made conscious. You have to build margin in each domain deliberately.
One thing we haven't touched on is how margin relates to creativity. I've noticed that my best ideas don't come when I'm working. They come in the shower, on a walk, in the in-between spaces.
I think you start with a domain that's causing the most pain. For most people, that's either time or money. If you're constantly stressed about bills, start with financial margin, even if it's tiny. There's solid neuroscience behind that.
Start small enough that it's actually sustainable. The mistake most people make with any life change is going too big, too fast, and then quitting.
Margin is what lets it come online.
The shower thought is not a coincidence. It's the default mode network finally getting airtime.
This is why the always-on culture is not just exhausting, it's actively stupid. Organizations that eliminate all Slack are eliminating the conditions for insight. They're optimizing for execution at the cost of innovation.
Which is the corporate version of the brittle life. Efficient right up until it breaks.
Then everyone's surprised. We were running so well, how did this happen? You were running at 100% capacity with no reserves. This is exactly what happens. Not by choice. By the rhythms of agricultural life, by the pace of pre-industrial work, by the lack of always-on communication. The idea that every moment should be productive is a very recent invention.
You can't sell margin on a before and after basis because the after looks the same as the before, just with fewer disasters. It's like trying to sell insurance by pointing to houses that didn't burn down.
The absence of crisis is a terrible marketing pitch, which is why the self-help industry barely touches margin and instead sells optimization. Maximize your morning routine. Hack your productivity. Fit more into your day. Margin is the opposite of all of that. It's fit less into your day and be okay with it.
That book would sell 12 copies. Living exactly at your means is invisible. Until something unexpected happens, and then it looks like the unexpected thing was the problem, not the lack of margin.
Unexpected things are not actually unexpected. They're just individually unpredictable. You don't know which week your car will break down, or which month your kid will get sick, or which year your industry will have layoffs. Preaching to the choir, but yes.
What about the relationship between margin and technology? Because I think a lot of what's eroded margin in the last 20 years is the removal of natural buffers.
And the average case is a mathematical fiction anyway. No actual month is perfectly average. No actual week goes exactly according to plan. Designing a life around the average is designing for failure.
Now the notification arrives instantly and demands an instant response. 2. Pick one domain and create a small protected buffer. 3. Defend that buffer against the cultural pressure to fill it. That's the hard part. 4. Let the experience of having margin teach you what you've been missing. And 5. Recognize that some of this is structural, not individual, and that policy choices about wages, scheduling, healthcare, and housing are margin decisions, whether we call them that or not.
That's a really solid summary. And I'd add one more layer, which is that margin is fundamentally about agency. When you have no slack, you have no choices. Every decision is forced by the constraints. Margin is what creates the space for choice. Which is why individual solutions are necessary but insufficient. Yes, turn off notifications. Yes, set screen time limits.
Autonomy and agency. That's what you said before, in a different conversation. Margin is the structural prerequisite for actually being free.
And we don't talk about it that way nearly enough.
Now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, a French engineer named Charles Auguste de Boisseau, living in self-imposed exile on the island of Réunion, built a mechanical computer designed to calculate the optimal breeding pairs of the island's rare Bourbon Island giant tortoises with the local population of feral donkeys. The machine used over 200 interlocking brass gears and was abandoned after it correctly predicted a tortoise-donkey friendship that the colonial administration found ideologically inconvenient.
All right.
I have so many questions, and I'm not going to ask any of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flemingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you got something out of this, leave us a review. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.